Welcome to Astounding Stories of Space and Time. I'm Margell, reading The Runaway Skyscraper by Murray Leinster. Part 1. The whole thing started when the clock on the Metropolitan Tower began to run backward. It was not a graceful proceeding. The hands had been moving onward in their customary deliberate fashion, slowly and thoughtfully, but suddenly the people in the offices near the clock's face heard an ominous creaking and groaning. There was a slight, hardly discernible shiver through the tower, and then something gave with a crash. The big hands on the clock began to move backward. Immediately after the crash, all the creaking and groaning ceased, and instead, the usual quiet again hung over everything. One or two of the occupants of the upper offices put their heads out into the halls, but the elevators were running as usual, the lights were burning, and all seemed calm and peaceful. The clerks and stenographers went back to their ledgers and typewriters. The business callers returned to the discussion of their errands, and the ordinary course of business was resumed. Arthur Chamberlain was dictating a letter to Estelle Woodward, his sole stenographer. When the crash came, he paused, listened, and then resumed his task. It was not a difficult one. Talking to Estelle Woodward was at no time an onerous duty, but it must be admitted that Arthur Chamberlain found it difficult to keep his conversation strictly upon his business. He was at this time engaged in dictating a letter to his principal creditors, the Gary and Milton Company, explaining that their demand for the immediate payment of the installment then due upon his office furniture was untimely and unjust. A young and budding engineer in New York never has too much money, and when he is young, as Arthur Chamberlain was, and is fond of pleasant company, and not too fond of economizing, he is liable to find all demands for payment untimely, and he usually considers them unjust as well. Arthur finished dictating the letter and sighed. "Miss Woodward," he said regretfully, "I am afraid I shall never make a successful man." Miss Woodward shook her head vaguely. She did not seem to take his remark very seriously, but then she had learned never to take any of his remarks seriously. She had been puzzled at first by his manner of treating everything with a half-joking pessimism, but now ignored it. She was interested in her own problems. She had suddenly decided that she was going to be an old maid, and it bothered her. She had discovered that she did not like anyone well enough to marry, and she was in her 22nd year. She was not a native of New York, and the few young men she had met there she did not care for. She had regretfully decided she was too finicky, too fastidious, but could not seem to help herself. She could not understand their absorption in boxing and baseball, and she did not like the way they danced. She had considered the matter and decided that she would have to reconsider her former opinion of women who did not marry. Heretofore, she had thought there must be something the matter with them. Now she believed that she would come to their own estate, and probably for the same reason. She could not fall in love, and she wanted to. She read all the popular novels and thrilled at the love scenes contained in them. But when any of the young men she knew became in the slightest degree sentimental, she found herself bored and disgusted with herself for being bored. Still, she could not help it and was struggling to reconcile herself to a life without romance. She was far too pretty for that, of course, and Arthur Chamberlain often longed to tell her how pretty she really was, but her abstracted air held him at arm's length. He lay back at ease in his swivel chair and considered, looking at her with unfeigned pleasure. She did not notice it, for she was so much absorbed in her own thoughts that she rarely noticed anything he said or did when they were not in the line of her duties. "Miss Woodward," he repeated, "I said I think I'll never make a successful man. Do you know what that means?" She looked at him mutely, polite inquiry in her eyes. "It means," he said gravely, "that I'm going broke. Unless something turns up in the next 3 weeks or a month at the latest, I'll have to get a job."
"And that means?" she asked.
"All this will go to pot," he explained with a sweeping gesture. "I thought I'd better tell you as much in advance as I could."
"You mean you're going to give up your office? And me?" she asked, a little alarmed.
"Well, giving you up will be the harder of the two," he said with a smile. "But that's what it means. You'll have no difficulty finding a new place with the 3 weeks in which to look for one. But I'm sorry."
"I'm sorry too, Mr. Chamberlain," she said, her brow puckered. She was not really frightened, because she knew she could get another position, but she became aware of rather more regret than she had expected. There was silence for a moment.
"Jove," said Arthur suddenly, "it's getting dark, isn't it?"
It was. It was growing dark with unusual rapidity. Arthur went to his window and looked out.
"Funny," he remarked in a moment or two. "Things don't look just right down there somehow. There are very few people about." He watched in growing amazement. Lights came on in the streets below, but none of the buildings lighted up. It grew darker and darker.
"It shouldn't be dark at this hour," Arthur exclaimed.
Estelle went to the window by his side.
"It looks awfully queer," she agreed. "It must be an eclipse or something."
They heard doors open in the hall outside, and Arthur ran out. The halls were beginning to fill with excited people.
"What on earth's the matter?"
asked a worried stenographer.
"Probably an eclipse," replied Arthur, "only it's odd we didn't read about it in the papers."
He glanced along the corridor. No one else seemed better informed than he, and he went back into his office.
Estelle turned from the window as he appeared.
"The streets are deserted," she said in a puzzled tone. "What's the matter? Did you hear?"
Arthur shook his head and reached for the telephone.
"I'll call up and find out," he said confidently. He held the receiver to his ear.
"What the?"
he exclaimed.
"Listen to this."
A small-sized roar was coming from the receiver. Arthur hung up and turned a blank face upon Estelle.
"Look,"
she said suddenly and pointed out of the window. All the city was now lighted up, and such as the signs as they could see were brilliantly illumined. They watched in silence.
The streets once more seemed filled with vehicles. They darted along, their headlamps lighting up the roadway brilliantly.
There was, however, something strange even about their motion. Arthur and Estelle watched in growing amazement and perplexity.
Are you seeing what I am seeing?" asked Estelle breathlessly. "I see them going backward."
Arthur watched and collapsed into a chair.
"For the love of Mike," he exclaimed softly.
He was roused by another exclamation from Estelle.
"It's getting light again," she said.
Arthur rose and went eagerly to the window. The darkness was becoming less intense, but in a way Arthur could hardly credit. Far to the west, over beyond the Jersey Hills, easily visible from the height at which Arthur's office was located, a faint light appeared in the sky, grew stronger, and then took on a reddish tint. That in turn grew deeper, and at last the sun appeared, rising unconcernedly in the west. Arthur gasped. The streets below continued to be thronged with people and motor cars. The sun was traveling with extraordinary rapidity. It rose overhead, and as if by magic, the streets were thronged with people. Everyone seemed to be running at top speed. The few teams they saw moved at a breakneck pace. Backward. In spite of the suddenly topsy-turvy state of affairs, there seemed to be no accidents. Arthur put his hands to his head.
"Miss Woodward," he said pathetically, "I'm afraid I've gone crazy. Do you see the same things I do?"
Estelle nodded, her eyes wide open.
"What is the matter?"
she asked helplessly. She turned again to the window. The square was almost empty once more. The motor cars, still traveling about the streets, were going so swiftly they were hardly visible. Their speed seemed to increase steadily. Soon it was almost impossible to distinguish them. Only a grayish blur marked their paths along Fifth Avenue and 23rd Street. It grew dusk, and then rapidly dark. As their office was on the western side of the building, they could not see that the sun had sunk in the east, but subconsciously they realized that this must be the case. In silence, they watched the panorama grow black, except for the street lamps, remain thus for a time, then suddenly spring into brilliantly illuminated activity. Again, this lasted for a little while, and the west once more began to glow. The sun rose somewhat more hastily from the Jersey hills and began to soar overhead, but very soon darkness fell again. With hardly an interval, the city became illuminated, and then the west grew red once more.
"Apparently," said Arthur, steadying his voice with a conscious effort, "there's been a cataclysm somewhere. The direction of the Earth's rotation has been reversed, and its speed immensely increased. It seems to take only about 5 minutes for a rotation now."
As he spoke, darkness fell for the third time. Estelle turned from the window with a white face.
"What's going to happen?" she cried.
"I don't know," answered Arthur. "The scientist fellows tell us if the Earth were to spin fast enough, the centrifugal force would throw us all off into space. Perhaps that's what's going to happen."
Estelle sank into a chair and stared at him, appalled. There was a sudden explosion behind them. With a start, Estelle jumped to her feet and turned. A little gilt clock over her typewriter desk lay in fragments. Arthur hastily glanced at his own watch.
"Great bombs and little cannonballs," he shouted. "Look at this!"
His watch trembled and quivered in his hand. The hands were going around so swiftly it was impossible to watch the minute hand, and the hour hand traveled like the wind. While they looked, it made two complete revolutions. In one of them, the glory of daylight had waxed, waned, and vanished. In the other, darkness reigned except for the glow from the electric light overhead. There was a sudden tension and catch in the watch. Arthur dropped it instantly. It flew to pieces before it reached the floor. "If you've got a watch," Arthur ordered swiftly, "stop it this instant." Estelle fumbled at her wrist. Arthur tore the watch from her hand and threw open the case. The machinery inside was going so swiftly it was hardly visible. Relentlessly, Arthur jabbed a pen holder in the works. There was a sharp click, and the watch was still. Arthur ran to the window. As he reached it, the sun rushed up. Day lasted a moment. There was darkness, and then the sun appeared again. "Miss Woodward," Arthur ordered suddenly, "look at the ground." Estelle glanced down. The next time the sun flashed into view, she gasped. The ground was white with snow.
"What has happened?" she demanded, terrified. "Oh, what has happened?"
Arthur fumbled at his chin awkwardly. watching the astonishing panorama outside. There was hardly any distinguishing between the times the sun was up and the times it was below now, as the darkness and light followed each other so swiftly. The effect was the same as one of the old flickering motion pictures. As Arthur watched, this effect became more pronounced. The tall Fifth Avenue building across the way began to disintegrate. In a moment, it seemed there was only a skeleton there. Then that vanished, story by story. A great cavity in the earth appeared, and then another building became visible, a smaller brownstone, unimpressive structure. With bulging eyes, Arthur stared across the city. Except for the flickering, he could see almost clearly now. He no longer saw the sun rise and set. There was merely a streak of unpleasantly brilliant light across the sky. Bit by bit, building by building, the city began to disintegrate and become replaced by smaller, dingier buildings. In a little while, these began to disappear and leave gaps where they vanished. Arthur strained his eyes and looked far downtown. He saw a forest of masts and spars along the waterfront for a moment. And when he turned his eyes again to the scenery near him, it was almost barren of houses, and what few showed were mean, small residences, apparently set in the midst of farms and plantations. Estelle was sobbing.
"Oh, Mr. Chamberlain," she cried, "what is the matter? What has happened?"
Arthur had lost his fear of what their fate would be in his absorbing interest in what he saw. He was staring out of the window wide-eyed, lost in the sight before him. At Estelle's cry, however, he reluctantly left the window and patted her shoulder awkwardly.
"I don't know how to explain it," he said uncomfortably, "but it's obvious that my first surmise was all wrong. The speed of the Earth's rotation can't have been increased, because if it had to the extent we see, we'd have been thrown off into space long ago. But have you read anything about the fourth dimension?"
Estelle shook her head hopelessly.
Well then, have you ever read anything by Wells, The Time Machine, for instance?"
Again she shook her head.
"I don't know how I'm going to say it so you'll understand, but time is just as much a dimension as length and breadth. From what I can judge, I'd say there has been an earthquake, and the ground has settled a little with our building on it, only instead of settling down toward the center of the earth or sideways, it's settled in this fourth dimension."
"But what does that mean?"
asked Estelle uncomprehendingly.
"Well, if the earth had settled down, we'd have been lower. If it had settled to one side, we'd have been moved one way or another. But as it settled in the fourth dimension, we're going back in time."
"Then
we're in a runaway skyscraper bound for some time back before the discovery of America."
Please join me next time for another chapter of The Runaway Skyscraper by Murray Leinster, here on Astounding Stories of Space and Time. Until then, watch the skies. Thank you.